This is October 31st, and I'm Eleanor Slent interviewing James Boyd. This is our, actually our fourth interview session, isn't it?
Is it really?
Yeah, well, the other one was in three sections, so we're continuing the interview, and we're here in Carmel Valley on a beautiful Halloween day.
Isn't it beautiful? Yeah, lovely. Think it'll keep the gremlins out tonight?
I think so.
Yeah. Well, this was about the time that General Clay came into the materials picture in the Army. Remember, I had come to work for the Undersecretary of War in the Army-Navy Munitions Board. And then when they all reorganized the Army and the Navy to handle the supply questions, this was after Pearl Harbor.
Okay.
The Army set up materials division, and General Clay was appointed the director of, director of materials for the Army under General Somerville,
mm-hmm.
who was the chief of supply. It happens that the engineers were given the job of provision of materials and supply. The doughboys became the fighting soldiers, and that was one of General Clay's concerns, that he had gone to West Point, he had been trained as a soldier, and here he was back in Washington sitting behind a desk, and it didn't please him very well. And later on in his career, when some things had happened, which I'll tell you about, he went on a trip around the world to look at how the supply was going, what the problems were, and then General Somerville went and later to North Africa and saw some questions. In the meantime, I'm going too fast. I better leave that going and fit it into the story. So
it was the chain of command was Somerville,
Clay,
Boyd.
Boyd, yeah. Mm-hmm.
This is Army.
Yeah.
And you had a similar thing in the Navy.
Yes, that was
General
Robinson. No, the Marines would be part of the Navy. And then they had
there was a maritime...
Maritime commission.
Commission.
Yeah. That was...
It was in the picture.
That
also.
Was General Larry... Admiral Lamb. And I'll tell you some stories about him in a while.
Okay.
And then there was a Vickery, he was his second command, and I went and watched him launch a ship one time and with him. The third in line of men opposite my in the maritime commission was a man who came out from one of the big corporations. And his boss came in the Maritime Commission on supply, and he came with him. And he was doing for the Maritime Commission what I was doing for the Army. His name was Berlage, B-E-R-L-A-G-E.
Mm-hmm.
And so we lived together for a while, because my family hadn't arrived yet.
Mm-hmm.
And he had an apartment downtown on 16th Street, so until my family came, I lived in this apartment with him, so I could work with him.
Now, you haven't said very much about conditions in Washington at that time. Is there anything that you'd like to mention about that?
Well,
how you went about finding a house and when...
Well, when I was asked to come into the Army, I didn't know whether I'd be there for a month or I'd go off to fight or what it would be. And so I looked around for a place to rent. and I found a place out in Maryland, just over the border from Washington, D.C., at the end of Massachusetts Avenue. And I rented that house but I stayed with the lodge until the family was ready to move from Denver.
Now, your family consisted of how many children?
My wife, a young lady that worked for us, and her child, and my two eldest sons. My two younger sons were born in Washington after we had been there a while.
Mm-hmm.
There were a lot of people moving out of Washington, D.C. For instance, the bank, I've forgotten the title of these names, it's hard to find mm-hmm. now, but it was the organization, the government, that guaranteed the banks. And they decided we would need more space in Washington, they moved them to Chicago.
Oh.
And one of them had a very nice house out in Arlington. And when we moved into the Pentagon building a little later, I was looking for a house close to the Pentagon building, and we gave up that house we were renting in Maryland, and we had that house down in Virginia in Arlington for the rest of the time we were there.
Mm-hmm.
So, and by that time, the two younger ones had born. But it was time for Brown and Bruce to begin to go to school, and they went to the schools in Arlington, Virginia. Now, we had a brand new car before we left New York, Denver. We could see what was coming on, and it was getting hard to find a car, and we had an old, we had two cars, as a matter of fact, because I had to commute out to Golden, and she was, and out in the field, and she had to have a car inside. But we gave those two, and bought, a friend of ours bought us, gave us, he ran a Chrysler agency, and he mm-hmm. sold us a Chrysler, which we brought back to Washington with us and had with us through all the war, through the war.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we did, and it was quite a while after the war before we could get another one.
Mm-hmm.
And another friend of ours had the agency for Chrysler in Mexico. And we saw him one night, and he said, well, he could manage something about that. So one day he called up, and by the time we'd gotten into Maryland, and said to Ruth, your car is here in Detroit.
Mm.
So I had to put her in the car. Well, this time, without salary. This was after the war, after we'd gone back to Washington. And it was a DeSoto Suburban. It had three seats in front of the baggage compartment with a rail on top. Clear out to Montana and back with the whole old. Remember, this the family now consists of four sons. That lady was working for me. So there were six of us and two of them, that's eight to the family. We all traveled a lot. I think a tuxedo and things like that in this car.
Oh my.
We went through a tornado and we got into St. Louis. And we saw houses up. Filled the trees down, we realized we'd seen a little wind and a little rain. We didn't realize we were coming into Detroit.
Oh my.
So we have that.
But that Chrysler was the later one.
That was the DeSoto.
DeSoto.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now we got in it again.
From Mexico.
Yeah, it had a kilometer speedometer on it. It was all at the. It was built to be sold in Mexico. He sold it to us in Mexico, and we had it delivered up to Detroit and drove the thing back down to Washington.
Mm-hmm. drove east from Denver then?
No, the ship, they came by train, and they shipped it. At that time, we had two cars. We still had the old Chrysler.
So you drove to work then, Maryland, downtown to Washington?
Yeah, that was of course when I was with the Bureau of Mines.
Well, but when you were going back to the wartime, you were able to drive to work.
I was able to drive
find
to
a
Washington.
Place to park.
As much as I was with General Clay,
just thinking how times
I had
changed.
A parking space on the work where I could get.
Uh-huh.
I don't remember where it was now. Remember, I was still in the.
Traffic wasn't too bad?
Wasn't then, because there weren't many cars around.
No.
It took a while, even after the war, before cars became. When I started driving from Maryland into the interior building, when I wrecked the Bureau of Mines, it would take me about 20 minutes. Near a year before, it was taking me almost 45 or 50 minutes to get downtown. The traffic could do that.
Later.
Yeah. That time I bought a small English car there.
Mm.
And then Ruthie had to have it.
You were back.
When we went into Washington as director of the Bureau of Mines, I bought a house in Maryland.
Again in Maryland.
In Maryland.
Okay.
Yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
Both of them in Maryland.
Yes. Okay.
And we moved to Virginia.
Uh-huh.
And so it was. Because I had to come into the Pentagon building. There's no other way to get in there. And but there was a friend around that would occasionally drive me in so she could have the car to go on shopping to. For instance, she would go to the commissary in Fort Lewis, and one day she was in there, and I'd just been around the house, and Ruthie said to her, can I drive you home with this package? She said, oh, would you? And her house was in on the fort, you see,
uh-huh.
It was just for the generals to have. And, well, if you will do it, she got a couple of packages.
Uh-huh.
And she went down, and Ruthie took her home, and she took the boys in with her, and Esther Kay is what the boys called her by this time, Mrs. Kay, Mrs. Clay, got cookies for them. And she said, can I go shopping with you? And Ruthie said, yes. He said, well, you know, I didn't think I was at your dinner party. I wasn't very bright, because my closest friend's son had been killed in the war.
Oh.
And that was the man, that was the general who had the bomb delivered to New Mexico for the first blast. He had the receipt he always carried with him for the delivery of that. Well, now we're ahead again.
Okay.
Now we're going back to Clay.
All right.
Coming in. So let me pick it up.
Mm-hmm.
Before we really had, Clay had taken over, they were getting organized, and they had people that Clay had picked to help him with his job. He knew well what it was. And they had to pick up my end of it from what was then the first.
Now this is taking from a civilian agency.
Yeah, well, in the military department.
It had been military, but not on a war
kind
of
right.
footing.
That's right. I was still, by the time Clay got there, I was in uniform because
mm-hmm.
the war had started. I'm now back
mm-hmm.
before Clay got there.
Yes.
But Joe Wood, or General Wood later, came in and was helping Clay get organized. And when he came in to the undersecretary's office and saw my castles on my uniform, engineer, that's why I started to tell you that, because the engineers were pretty well took over the supply. Mm-hmm. And that because Clay was an engineer officer, so it was I should have known what I was in. And did I tell you the story about airplanes and aluminum? One Sunday morning, later General Wood was there present, some of the officers I'm talking about. And he had a letter from Roosevelt saying, we will build 10,000 airplanes a year. And he had a note from, he'd been sitting down with Lord Beaverbrook, and Lord Beaverbrook had told the president that we'd need 10,000 airplanes. Didn't say whether bombers or fighters or transport planes or all the kinds of planes you need. So I came down in the morning, and all this gathering of I think he called me personally, because he called me Jim from the very beginning. He said, what are we doing? I said, we've got to build a plant. How are you going to go about that? I said, well, this is my job, because I have a branch of the quantities division. So at this time, the chairman of the munitions board, Army Navy Mission, we're not in New York, we're going to New York. And he called me in one day, and he had, he wanted a name drop, Ferdinand Ebergard, because it was a power on Wall Street. And he was obviously with to sit between the Undersecretary of War and the Undersecretary of Navy, which was Jim Forrestal. He had to be somewhat powerful. Mm-hmm. And, so he asked Bonnie Baruch. Remember, Bonnie Baruch had been in charge of war production in the First World. Mm-hmm. And for two solid days, Ferdinand Emmerstadt, Baruch and I stopped and talked about all these things and how you organize and do it. I had to learn a lot from him. It was long enough, so I got to know Baruch well enough. And later on, when I started coming to New York, I belonged to the Australian American Association, and I'd go there, and then Bonnie would be there. And he was a very heavy man, tall, heavy. And he'd say, hey, come on over here, boy. I want to pick your brains. And I have to tell him all the things I've been doing, and because he would like to sit down in the corner of the room.
Was he a... Hmm? Did he have an Australian connection?
Well, I suppose he had a connection to all over the world. Bonnie Baruch was a financial man that made his money on the market. But he used to go and sit in the park, Lafayette mm-hmm. Park, and the great powers used to come back and talk to him, and he'd help them.
Very thoughtful.
So. Yeah.
He probably financed mining in Australia.
Oh, well, I'm sure he did. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he probably helped too, but I would mm-hmm. think. Mm-hmm. Well, it turned out that what we'd have to have was an interdepartmental aluminum. Even the Air Force hadn't come anywhere near deciding how many and how much aluminum we would need to build. Of course, this then came up. job. So I have to work with him is fair. I'm somebody on my commission. I was now appointed to the on aluminum. Mm-hmm. I had to summon someone from the Air Force. You'll see how you have to handle these things.
Now, go back to this thing about Roosevelt. Was this, this was not a reasoned request?
Obviously, Roosevelt couldn't know all of the problems involved in bearing airplanes, or how you broke them up, and how many bombers you had to have, and how many fighter planes you had. It had to come out of the system. General figure that Lord Beaverbrook, who was in charge of the fly in London, had told him that he'd have to be planning for it. So they started the planning in the system. And the thing that started the planning in the system was through Robert Patterson, this guy up here. And of course, at that time, there was an assistant Undersecretary of Navy for Air, and he's one of the six great men that the world is in. Anyway, I got to know him later on. Who knows about airplanes? Who knows how much aluminum it takes to build an airplane? Rod, do you want wire, or how much, and castings, and forgings, and all these things, the way you handle aluminum. Only one company in the world that anything knew about it, and that was a place called Alcoa. So where are you going to get this information from? From Alcoa. So we talked, I think it was Bonnie, talked to Chief Wilson, who was then the president of Alcoa, and they sent down to me a fellow by the name of Cap Unger, U-N-G-E-R. He was an engineer, but a statistical expert. This is a great mind I'm introducing you to. Now, what's going to happen? We're going to have Alcoa sitting on this committee, in the departmental committee. You knew what the political situation would be like that. So we had to put Cap back in the back room because he's going to do all the work. Now, what does a country school teacher know about all these things? I have the faintest idea what a sheet was, or a rod, or whatever it may be. Mm-hmm. So. And then, of course, I didn't even dare go and have meals with him. I mean, certainly I couldn't accept a meal from Alcoa as a government. We had to live together.
What was his technical assignment then?
His technical assignment was to help me write this report, get this together.
I see.
And in fact, the matter, he was the guts of the whole committee.
Uh-huh.
Because he knew all these things. Of course, we did have people from the Air Force. We had a way to go to the people they were buying airplanes from and get this information, or they may not have had it themselves. Mm-hmm. So he needed all that kind of info. And he came up with how many bombers we'd need, how many fighting planes we'd need. The Joint Chief of Staff of the transport planes and planes and fighters, and he came to a conclusion. Running out?
No, it's okay.
And he put it on a piece of paper, and so we used this as a guide to how much aluminum we really need. Mm. How many plants we would have, forging plants we had to make, sheet plants we had to make, and so forth. Now, he would be working, of course, with the War Production Board, which wasn't the War Production Board yet, but it was something. And I just sat back as the chairman, so I kept track of it and so forth, and I'll tell you later on, I got into copper the same way. And but really, Cap did fundamentally all the work. He gave his whole time to it, mm-hmm. and I couldn't give my whole time to it. I had to worry about anything about it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
When the war was over, I was in Pittsburgh, and he had gone back to Alcoa. And I looked him up, and I said, Cap, have you got those reports that you wrote out on that one? He said, yeah, you have them safe, because they're all top secret. And we got him out, and we actually produced in the war to within 5% of the number of planes he had used, and the mix of planes was what they actually would produce. Now that shows the greatness of that mind. Mm. And here he was stuck back in a room. He was no public appearance at all.
Right.
He went back to Alcoa as a statistician.
Yeah.
But Alcoa couldn't do without him, and we couldn't do without him, and that's how that came about.
Mm-hmm.
So that then who signs the blessed thing? But the signs of Jim Boyd, James Boyd. Right? Well, this time I was a major. I've been got a little up rank.
Now, was this Unger?
Unger.
Was he a civilian still, or was he given military?
No. He wasn't even paid, nor was Alcoa paid by the government. He did this all as a member of this committee on loan from Alcoa. As far as I know, I don't know. I wouldn't know the details. We just had to be careful that we didn't let any of the politicians know that an Alcoa man, but there was no place else to get the information.
Yeah.
Nobody else produced aluminum, because they used these things. Yeah. Remember, aluminum was relatively new metal by this,
right.
1941.
The Air Force already had some planes made.
All aluminum. Yeah, mm-hmm. So they did have contracts out for building airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
And, but we were still building fabric planes and some of those things. But they did. They were the gas cost procurement went stupid. They had been fighting with this problem for some time. There wasn't anything new.
Now, how did you get authorization to build your staff? Did you have to go to somewhere?
Oh yeah, I had to go to. Well, my boss was a major and later on a full colonel in the medical corps, and he was in charge of the commodities division. And he'd gotten there because he'd seen. He was the one that sent me out to study the mobilization plan, which had been written by the Army Industrial College in peacetime. And he wouldn't let me do anything until when I came aboard, till I'd read that thing through from beginning to end. He was my assistant, and as a matter of fact, he ran it while I was going to learn. And I had to go around and meet all the people in the Bureau of Mines and the Geological Survey and the War Production Board. One day, the civilian agency, where are all the certificates of necessity that allowed us to build our copper plants and our aluminum plants and so forth. That's supposed to be in my office. I'm supposed to approve them. This fellow, he got sick one day and he went off and I went into his desk. His desk was full of copper. So I had a 19-year-old young lady who was my secretary, and she was a gem. And I had five different letterheads. I had five different hats on. And she would know which letterhead to put this on. Mm. And I would work on these things all day. We'd sit and write them. I'd even have to ride her home at night because I didn't want her on the streets at night. Mm-hmm. And I had to go out and call out and see whether we needed this thing or not, and what we needed to do and why we needed it and what the requirements for it and all this kind of thing. And I would pass on it. And for the Army, I signed my name on these certificates of necessity. And they went over there, and that gave the authority of the War Production Board, and they could contact like Kennecott and Phelps Dodge and Alcora, and then they could go ahead and plan, and then when the time to come taxes, they could more quickly than you would normally. Appreciation.
Was there any recourse if a company wanted to appeal some of this?
Go to the courts, or they could go to there were parts of the department. I will get into this because I'll show you the structure of Clay's office later on.
Well, and that's what I was
wondering. I'll show you how we get into this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So now where are we?
Well, see, you were.
Now this is.
Gone to Baruch and Everstadt and were.
Yeah, well, they after that talk, we set up these two, first of all, the aluminum committee.
Mm-hmm.
And then while that was going on, we set up a copper committee, and I got somebody from the copper industry to come and do the same thing that Kent Unger was doing for aluminum.
There's been a lot of companies involved.
Yeah, a lot of companies involved. Mm-hmm. That was a little bit more technical. I don't remember quite how we did that, but we did it so that it was clear and everybody had a voice in it.
Mm-hmm.
We would go to all the companies and they would give us the figures and we would put together, but there had to be staff there to do this, because I didn't have much staff.
Mm-hmm.
A fellow by the name of Coe was a family. Clemmy worked for Ambassador Coe at one time. He must have come from the same family because they're quite wealthy and they own Nebraska, you know, some of them.
Mm-hmm.
And he was there to help me do this. And I signed that report too when he was done. And out of that came the expansion of the plants that we needed. For instance, you read in John's book the story about how the Combined Resources Board were up against a problem because we needed to send brass strip to make ammunition to England and do it here too.
Mm-hmm.
And then how would you divide that up? And he tells the story of how it got done. Mm-hmm. Well, John and I did it, really. It got signed by the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, of the Combined Chiefs of Staff, was transmitted to the chairman of the war, the War Production Board, but actually, John and I did the whole thing.
That was the.
I was a military
side. Came down and went back up again.
Because when I came over, we wrote the letter. Came over there, and the Joint Chiefs of Staff set it up. Who do they put on the committee? But me. Nobody else made anybody. So I had some other people on the committee, and we did it. We wrote the letter back and said, doing what they finally. And when Nelson saw it, he had the faintest idea what had gone on. John gave it to him, and he thought that John had done the whole thing. And John and I had written the letter out together for him to sign to the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
Mm-hmm.
But that's how it worked, because how could an Army general or an admiral or a Navy know anything about this kind of stuff? They had to bring in people like us to do the thinking for them.
Mm-hmm. Now, Fennelly mentioned in his book that at one point that he felt that the professors were more competent than, he said, professors showed greater understanding than business. What Fennelly said was that professors showed greater understanding than businessmen of governmental machinery and greater flexibility in adapting themselves to red tape. And he must have been speaking about you.
Yeah, well, I think maybe how I got there, because I wasn't the only professor he dealt with. I'm sure I wasn't the only one, but working together, he was a businessman after all. He would have been a vice president of Law Forgan in Chicago, one of the big financial houses there. And
so the people came from finance, from academics, from business.
From business. Where else would they come from?
That's it. For industry, finance, and academia.
That's where it had to come from.
And it's interesting that you and Fennelly both seem to feel that the businessmen were less adept.
It was harder then. You see, a businessman has to set up procedures and stay within those procedures. And when you're working in the government, you've got so many angles coming from all directions. You have to be flexible enough to take into these things. Well, I haven't thought about it that way. But what they liked about me from the War Production Board, and this has been mentioned in many places, is that if they wanted anything done in the Army, they'd call me up. And I seemed to know where to go. And I knew that if you had to get anything done inside the military, or for that matter in the civilian agency, you had to know who had authority and who had knowledge and where you got this information to. If you get crossed up with the red tape, you're just hopeless. You can't just go to anybody. You've got to go to the right place. And because of that training that Colonel Morgan gave me, I knew where to go. And so I could, someone call me up and say, we can't get this done, so-and-so in the ordnance department. Well, I have friends down the ordnance department, I call them up and say, what about this? And Somerville had made very clear. He didn't want all these memorandum going back and forth. It's what what's the telephone for? And so I'd call up and arrange for this to be done, or get this information out. And within maybe a matter of hours or minutes, I was able to get them to the right place and get the right information. So I suppose that's where that came from.
And Morgan, you say, gave you some instructions.
Well, he was the one that see who did what the mobilization plan was and how it worked. That was a few people get into government that have that kind of training. And that carried me forward. I went to Germany.
And of course, this has been one of your top skills all through your life, hasn't it? This ability to...
I suppose from there on it has, I don't know if we had it before. Well, I guess I was a crew chief in the field when I was only a year out of college, or less than a year out of college.
So you had the skill, the ability.
I guess
ability.
I had it. It must have been inbred or something.
It's not something you were taught in.
No, I guess you have to learn.
Of course, in college, exactly.
Yeah. Well, I don't know, when you think that I was taught at Caltech, you've asked this question. I started out to be a civil engineer because I thought that was a good, electrical engineer, that's a good thing. Then my friends were civil engineers, so I changed to civil. But at the end of the sophomore year, you had to make up your mind what you're going to be. And I decided, I had a friend who was a mechanical engineer, he was going to design airplanes, and I was going to fly them and so on. And so I decided that what I needed to do was to study economics. I had a feeling that one day my ambition would be someday to be a president of it was a copper company. suspect that it was that training with the engineering background. I had to become an engineer. Going back a little bit.
Okay, yes. Well, let's get back then. So, Unger came up.
Agreement between the departments, what had to be done. From there on, it was up to the Lunan Division of the War Production Board to get the plants built. And it was at this point that they realized they had to have somebody else but Alcoa in the business. And they brought Kaiser and Reynolds. Kaiser was a shipbuilder and a construction company. Mm-hmm. That's Henry Kaiser from out here. And then the Reynolds family wanted to get into aluminum. And so they gave contracts for them, and they put their organization together. So by the end of the war, we had three aluminum companies instead of one.
Mm-hmm.
But there was no skill there to depend on in the beginning of the war.
Mm-hmm.
They all had to depend upon Alcoa. And this was true. You realize the strength of the effort. For instance, when Clay, I was still over in the new War Department building. Clay had moved in. He had an office over in the munitions building, which was that long thing was built in the First World War on Constitution Avenue.
Mm.
His office was there. The Navy had the next one. There were two big buildings there. And I moved over with him until... Well, this time he'd picked me up, because I had taken him to the SPAB, the Supply Priorities and Allocations Board, and he liked what I had to say, and it got him out of a hole, and he never let me go until I left the Army and after we left Germany.
Mm-hmm.
He left me for a while, but he got me back. Because I was doing for Clay what was being done in the Navy by Admiral Robinson, there was an elderly admiral, three-striper, did the same, Admiral Williams, his name, in Nitro Farm. And they gave us an office, and here I had a high back leather chair, and I was still only a major, I think. By this time I was getting to be a lieutenant colonel. And had a very fancy desk, and the admiral sat next to me, and we worked together from that thing. Until the munitions boarding building, Pentagon building was almost finished. This was Somerville's Folly.
Mm-hmm.
It's still there, but it was Somerville's Folly. We moved there. There was an air-conditioned building. The munitions building wasn't. It was a hot summer. Do this thing with all the squares and Gerald Clay's, who came close friend of mine, was at that point a colonel, and he was came from the Corps of Engineers, and he was one of Clay's assistants, and I really depended on him for my administrative work.
Do you want to say his name?
See his face. Well, I'm going to tell you something. I won't tell you his name, but there's no need for it to be on top. But when I got to Germany, I had the Eagles. By this time, I was a full colonel. The Eagles had no authority at all. You had to have a star on your shoulder to get anything done. Mm. So I went to Clay and I said, "Now, in order to get to this job done, I'm going to need a general. Say, why don't you give me a general, and I'll be his executive officer, and we can run it that way. And who do you want?" I mentioned this man's name. "Can't have him. He's no good."
Huh?
That's how, you see, every one of these generals, or these men who grew in the Army and the Navy, kept a little black book, either in their mind or in their pocket. And every man they ever worked with, they kept track of. And once they had picked and seen and got confidence in a man, just the way Clay had gone comes with me, they always took him along with them. That's why I went to Germany with him, for example. That's why Clay went into Somerville, because they'd been together. And Marshall came up a long way in the top to get to be the chief of staff. In other words, these men had demonstrated their abilities. And they were in somebody's mind that had the authority, and they would be, that's how they come along like that. And so the result is they were able to build up the competence of the Army and the Navy structure so quickly after 1941. And this is where I was working, in this atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
So you couldn't get any much better training than that.
That's
true. Mm-hmm. Clay taught me how to be an executive.
Did he?
Yeah.
Maybe this is a good time to tell us a little bit more about Clay and what sort of person he was in your mind. We've seen pictures of him. And
well, a hero.
Of course, there are a lot of books about him, but
I came as close to hero worshiping Clay as any man I've ever met. He says, "You know, really, Small would come and talk these things over with Jim before he goes to those meetings. We wouldn't have this kind of trouble. I never had another. The next week, I was invited to the flag officer's dining room over the munitions building. The nearest junior officer to me was a rear admiral. No, vice admiral. Rear admirals. Mm-hmm. And we never had any trouble. In fact, Jack and I became very close friends. And then pretty soon this man came along, and we saw, it's Milt Baker. I'll tell you some more about him. Without him, I wouldn't have been half the man I was. He was my real strength. We'll see later on. We haven't got to him yet.
All right. But you really liked Clay.
Yeah, in the first place, how long we were in the office. In the early days when I had this job, which he called, he made me the head of his office, the chief of the Office of Liaison and Coordination. It was my job to liaison with the War Production Board at the high levels and to coordinate with the services down the line. We were the quartermaster department, the medical department, the signal corps, the transportation corps, the engineer corps. There were seven of them. All the parts, and they all had responsibility for training the men and designing the equipment and doing the research, but they had to be coordinated. Mm-hmm. And so we were dealing the actual procurement and activities were done by them. And then worked with the War Production Board to see. And all the heads of each of those divisions were later on, one of them was head to the requirements division. The requirements division had to get from the planning staff, the Army and the Air Force, how many guns and how many tanks it would take to build up the forces. And every item of procurement. And General Wood came in one day to see Clay. He says, I'll be damned if I'll have these braziers in my Army supply program. Clay looked at him and said, well, we have wax, don't we? So he had to go up with his tail between his legs, and we had to have braziers in the house. There were a million items of procurement.
Did this include food as well as?
The quartermaster, food, and I had a, one day I'd have to deal with lumber or canvas duck or textiles, and the next day I'd have to deal with steel, the next day copper, and I'd go in to see the general in the morning, knowing what my agenda was today, and I would sit down on the edge of his overstuffed chair and kick my leg over it and start to tell him. And I'd talk, and I knew immediately when he understood that all he needed to know. I'd pass top of the little section. Then he would maybe ask a question or two. Sometimes he wouldn't say anything. And I'd go about my busy day all the day and do these things. And he never forgot what I said to him. Hmm. One day the Board of Economic Warfare called me up and said, we've got a real problem. The ships are going down, so we can't provide coal to England. We've got to coal in England. how are we going to procure it? He said, we can't reimburse it. They need an awful lot, and they, well, I can't remember the exact mechanics of it. But, he said, the Army will have to do it. And I said, well, you'll have to ask it. So we sat down and wrote a letter to General Clay and asked the Army to do this job. So I came in, I said to Clay, you know our problem with coal? He said, yes, he understood the problem. I said, the BW said they can't do it, and we'd have to do it. He said, well, we'll have to ask it. I said, well, I said, you want to accept? And he read the letter, and he said, yes. I said, well, here it is. So I gave him a letter to sign. He said, all right, Smarty, you go do it. Mm-hmm. Well, where do I go? This is mining equipment. Great big walking shovels that they were using for the levees on the rivers and things like that. And so I called up my friend, a colonel in charge of procurement and the Corps of Engineers, and we talked it over, and he accepted the job, and they hunted up all the equipment. And so we went over about two weeks. We wrote our report, what the machines were, how they'd be, and what they would produce, and so forth. And I turned to Clay. Okay, go ahead. I said, the son of a gun hasn't even read it. Uh-huh. I mean, I didn't use a simple word like that. I
mean, no.
Well, about 6 months later, well, one day the colonel called me and he says, you know, Jim, machine number two is supposed to leave from Newport News, and the ship to pick it up is down in New Orleans. Will you get the transportation corps to switch the trains around? Trains? Yeah, it takes two trains to get that one machine. It's an enormous machine. And so I arranged for it. The train went down and got on the boat. And so we've got this all moving, and we know what the times were. And fortunately, we had a very great man who became a great friend of mine later on, who ran one of the coal companies, not coal machinery houses, Joy Manufacturing. And he was over in England, and he knew enough about this so they worked it out. But anyway, I wrote the report up, and Clay thinks, this is not what you told me 6 months ago.
Oh, no.
I said, no, sir, I made some changes. I couldn't do this. I said, that's all right. But he remembered every business machine. And these machines, one machine might have two train loads of equipment. And we had to get all the spare parts for them, we had to get them produced, we had to send them along, tack them, and send them off to England.
Mm.
And that's made it possible for them to tear up some of this coal near the surface.
Mm.
And do without some of the shipping we were losing.
Mm.
Because it was my job to kind of keep track. Every night we had a report on how many ships were sunk, how many ships were going online to come off the ways to be produced, and we know what our total shipping was. And I had to have it available for the Clay and he, if we had to make decisions involving those such matters. And This is a routine thing that had to be in my mind all the time.
Hmm.
Yeah. So by this time, by the way, I was his executive officer, not just dealing with raw material.
So your job was not only to
collect
the materials, but to deliver them as well.
Later on. At the time, when I was the officer of liaison and coordination, we were dealing entirely with the materials that were being produced, the mines, and things like that. For instance, if the War Production Board needed some advice and approval of the Army to do certain things, such as closing the gold mines, as you talked about, they would come to Clay, and then Clay would talk to me about it, or and I would check in to see what was needed. If we needed manpower going out of the copper mine, we had to have copper. And so we began to let men out of the army who were being drafted in Utah or someplace, they could go back to work in the mines, so we'd get copper out. And that was the thing we had to work with the manpower division and so forth. And it was there he kind of said to me, well, now what's the point of my having, if we're having to let men out of the army to run the copper mines, why do we keep men in the gold mines? And I think maybe I had to, at least 5 minutes of thinking about that. And I couldn't see any reason why we would, you have to be brutal. Like another time, in the early days when I first came with Clay, we found we didn't have enough nickel to make all the armor plate. Armor plate needed nickel to make it stronger, because there was a specification put out for making it. But Bethlehem Steel, in the meantime, had found another alloy that took less nickel. So what we had to do was to get Bethlehem to release that secret information, and then we had to sit up all night and see all the melt schedules against the, have the ordnance people in, and the people from the industry in, and so forth. And this was working all night long. And I went down, I'd probably been there all night, I went down to Clay in the morning and said that some of the industry people are getting upset that they can't stand on their feet anymore. He said, generally, he says, in wartime, men's lives depend on these things. You don't consider those things. And so I went back to work. And what we did, we changed all our mill schedules so that we had then enough nickel to meet all the requirements for steel plate we needed and construction of ships, the Navy, and tanks and things like that, whatever they were needed for. So these are the kind of things we problems with. Now,
tremendous job.
Well, because there was no lack of interest. But you know, my children were with me, and by this time I had four, and Doug and Hudson, I probably never saw in those days. They were born in Washington, and they went up when I left in the morning, and they'd gone to bed before I came home at night. And maybe after a while we got Milton and I would go out on Sunday and take the afternoon off to cut wood so we would get some exercise.
Well, you were doing this really 7 days a week then?
Oh yeah. Yeah, in the beginning. Then gradually we began to get Sundays off. And sometimes I'll be there all night. It's a good thing I was in good physical shape. In the
yes, indeed.
Yeah. Clay wasn't a lot older than I. He was about 10 years older than I. Well, I think Finley says that, doesn't he? I think he says that I was 10 years his junior.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I guess that's
right. There must have been a point at which you could see that the war was
over?
Well, not over, but going to be over, and that you really had the procurement.
Oh, no. Before, long before that, there were these meetings of the Program Adjustment Committee, of which I was the Army member. The allocations we made with some argument, such as the chain thing.
Mm-hmm.
But what had happened while we were doing this, we knew that was coming up, that Milt, by this time, had come aboard, and he'd go around and work with all the under agencies and check with them. He had friends then, he made friends very easily, the way I did. And he could go and work directly with the white man ordnance or the quartermaster or the Corps of Engineers and be sure that the figures were right and that we could live with that kind of thing. Then I'd be ready to trade to balance this thing up. And so that's why Jen Fenley liked me there, because it made his job so much easier. He didn't have to sit there and be a guard and decide between the Army and the Navy and the Air Force and the civilian agencies and the Maritime Commission. We had worked it out in advance. We traded. Now one day, Jerry Land, who was the Admiral, Admiral Land, who was the Maritime Commission, I guess it was Eberstrom, the vice chairman. By this time, he'd left the Army Navy Mission Board and was over in the war production. And Clay took me along with him. But on the way over, the Admiral was asking for more steel plate. So I checked around before I went there. And on the way over in the car, I said to the General, I got 40,000 tons of steel. That didn't happen very often.
No.
Because if we hadn't done our work in the Program Adjustment Committee, with Fenley as chairman, and Small and I were on the Navy and the Army, and I had the Air Force too, and I had two colonels who sat behind me from the Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
With instructions from Cap Arnold, General Arnold, the head of the Air Force, to back Jim Boyd up. These fellows became my fast friends. They were colonels then, but one of them ended up as a four-star general, and the other was a three-star general. And then I had a very wonderful man, from the production division under our things, who would go with me, because he could go out and he always had a briefcase with him. He had all the figures. And when I needed to know a figure, he knew what I needed. He would pull out his briefcase and hand it to me.
Your job was to coordinate
yeah.
all of this material.
And I can tell you, working those hours, that there were times when they were dealing with things I didn't need to know anything about, and I would go to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
But as soon as anything came up in mind, I was wide awake. And I know that I must have obviously been asleep sometimes. I was really, you stay up all night, and you try to go to meetings all day.
Yeah, you were exhausted.
Yeah. I remember a lot of my life I've worked so intensely that I would sleep through, but have the capability of hearing something and waking up and when it was necessary that I went with going on.
It's quite a talent.
where are we?
Well, perhaps we're almost ready to go to Germany, do you think?
No, not yet.
Not yet, all right.
Because the next question you raise is we began to see the end.
When you had things sort of so they were going along.
We had the War Production Board, the distribution of materials.
Mm-hmm.
We had the association with great people in the War Production Board. And there was one, Bert Fox, the general, would show anything to you. He trusted the only one in the War Production Board he trusts.
Mm-hmm.
Bert and I are still friends. And he was an economist, he's with MIT, I guess now. And but it was going along, and the long debates would come about things like this. And the chairman, John Fenley, had left the War Production Board to go out and organize the Committee on Economic Development. Production.
Mm-hmm.
Try to meet all the demand for automobiles and beds and baby buggies and hairpins and things like that. And so he left. And Philemon and Link Gordon took a first place. I shouldn't mention him because this is a close friend of mine.
Okay.
I can expunge some of this. Way. But Link later was our ambassador to Brazil. He was president of John Hopkins University, but he took over from John Fenley when John left. And then there began to be long philosophical debates. And I said to Clay, look, my job's done. There's something more useful I can do. Well, what he did was, his executive officer was an ordnance colonel and an old friend, and he got him promoted to a brigadier general and sent him back to ordnance, and he took me in to his direct office. I had an office upstairs this time with Milton, and I became his executive officer. You cover this a bit. Remember that the production division and these two divisions under us had very powerful men in them. And
excuse me, I'm just a